Welcome to the Mormon News Report podcast for the week of September 4th, 2017. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
While strictly adhering to federal rules, regulations, and guidelines that you will get exactly 3.23 liters of snark, no more, no less.
Don't mess with the Trumpster when it comes to government rules and regulations. He'll get you. Hey, listen, we have a great show lined up for you today. Mehdi Harrison will be joining us to talk about her very interesting book, The Book of Layman, recently out by BCC Press.
You know, Brian, I didn't know what to expect when I read it, but wow, it is really a powerful book from a perspective that I don't think a lot of us are going to think about. I think everyone is really going to want to listen to this one, especially our extended sessions. And as such, let's talk about the extended sessions, shall we? The Mormon News Report extended sessions are available to all Patreon.com subscribers for just $1 a month. Guys, that's all we're asking. You'll receive access to our conversations with guests when we have the recording light turn off.
We loosen the ties, we crack open a cold one, and we have an off-the-record conversation.
Wait a minute. You wear a tie when you record? Okay, that's...
I take this seriously, Brent.
That's very true. And I'm really not sure how it's off the record if we're recording it.
Yeah, you know, don't worry about the details. I'm a big picture guy.
Okay, anyways, here's a sneak peek at one of the juicy little nuggets that Mehdi drops in the extended session this week.
I don't think you can understand the depth of God's love until you feel so broken and so worthless. And again, that's how Layman and I connect. I just felt like I had reached a bottom and felt like I wasn't Nephi anymore, and I was never going to be him again. I couldn't do the things. I didn't have the energy. I didn't have the strength of will that I'd once had. And yet, God still loved me.
Your $1 a month will help support our efforts to provide you with the best coverage, commentary, analysis, and just a sprinkling of snark to breaking Mormon news. It's simple. Just head over to patreon.com/Mormon News Report and become a Patreon subscriber today.
And there's many more ways that you can support us. A review on iTunes goes a long way. A share on Facebook or Twitter saying that this is the best snarky Mormon news coverage, or even a name drop at your local LDS ward.
You know what, guys? Here, we're going to show you exactly how easy it is in a segment that we like to call role playing.
Oh, here we go. Hey, Brent, how's it going?
I'm good, Brian. So hey, I'm listening to this new podcast. They talk about Mormon things.
It's not one of those podcasts, is it?
If by those podcasts you mean the best analysis and coverage of Mormon news with a sprinkling of snark, then yes, it is.
Are they funny?
They think they are.
Do they talk about the news, or do they just talk about each other?
They're taking this revolutionary approach to podcasting where they talk about actual news stories and try and give some background to what everyone might be saying about it. I mean, I don't even know if Brandt is a real person or not.
Okay. You have me convinced. So how do I find them?
You know what? Let me go ahead and send you the link. It'll be easy as pie.
See, everyone, it was that easy. So go share the love. Share the Mormon News Report. All right, Brandt. So tell me, what happened this week?
So it rained in Texas.
Yeah.
And then it rained some more.
So the rains came down and the floods came up. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my gosh, Brian, that is so Mormon. Holy crap, you fell right into that one. But seriously, folks, Hurricane Harvey hit Texas with the force of a Mike Tyson punch, and it's been downright scary to see the level of flooding and the impact that it's had on the people down there.
Brandon, times like this, I think that we see two things happen. We see the best of people and we see the worst of people. So give me some optimism here.
As a matter of fact, the outpouring of love and support from both the nation and the world, including, interestingly enough, Mexico, who the United States has been, we've had a bit of an interesting relationship with them ever since Donald Trump was elected, has been inspiring. The hard work of the volunteers has been rightly applauded and celebrated, and everyone seems to be pitching in to help down there. You know what? Even the Mormons got involved. And Brian, I think we all know, when the poop hits the fan, the Mormons know how to show up.
We are Legion, Brandt. As a matter of fact, one of the shining bright spots of Hurricane Harvey was the outpouring of support from local and religious organizations. BuzzFeed News, in an article about the response, or lack thereof, or a delayed response, or I don't know, whatever you want to call it, of Joel Osteen's Lakewood Church, noted, four mosques in the Islamic Society of Greater Houston are open as shelters, and at least 17 Houston area churches have been operating as shelters or temporary staging areas for evacuees. The Cypress Stake Center in Tomball, Texas, was one of those shelters and of staging areas, serving as the command post for the Harvey cleanup efforts after it was used as an impromptu shelter and boat rescue operation center earlier this week. The LDS Church also announced that at least 3 meeting houses have been used to temporarily shelter evacuees.
And while the Mormons were able to assist others, it's not like we weren't affected. Last Monday night, the LDS Church announced that floodwaters breached the Houston, Texas temple after a nearby creek rose more than 20 feet.
Houston Temple President Marshall Hayes said in a release to Mormon Newsroom, "It appears the water to the depth of 4 or 5 inches has gone inside the temple. That includes a baptistry, a marriage waiting room, dressing rooms, kitchen, and laundry. We haven't been able to go inside, so we really don't know the extent of the damage." Now, Brant, because online Mormons are always going to mourn, there is almost always some instant criticism. And in this case, the criticism was on the Houston Temple that it wasn't immediately opened for displaced Texans. Criticisms like the Mormons think that their temples are too sacred for everybody's dirty feet and other negative and snarky remarks were lobbed by, well, unsurprisingly, mostly ex-Mormons on social media. However, none of them seemed to bother asking whether the temple was actually usable for that purpose, or perhaps whether it may have also fallen victim to the flood as well. So,
you know, Brian, people like that are always looking for something to complain about. Sometimes their complaints are legit. Oftentimes, well, I think they get a little mud in their eye.
Probably literally in this case.
Mm-hmm. In more Hurricane Harvey news, the LDS Church also confirmed that though several missions were affected, all missionaries are safe. Quote, "Each companionship gathered enough food and water to shelter for several days, and some missionaries were moved out of areas where the greatest flooding potential existed."
So I'm glad to see that food storage is at work.
Of course, first of all, here.
But not all parents of missionaries were satisfied this report. So John O'Connor, father of one of the elders who's serving in the Houston area, got into a bit of an email fight with his son's mission president after he wasn't granted access to make direct contact with his son.
Here's a clip from that interview that John O'Connor did about this incident.
"I want to hear his voice. I want to hear that what that feeling of confidence that comes from hearing someone, that confidence that my son may have given me through his own voice. I just wanted to know that how my son was feeling, if he felt safe."
Look, I don't blame this dad at all. Your kid is in a major disaster area. Of course, you're going to want a little reassurance that he's okay. What parent wouldn't?
While I imagine that this mission president had his reasons for responding the way that he did, I can't help but look at this as an example of placing rules above common sense.
Ultimately, Mr. O'Connor did receive an email from his son assuring them that he was fine and that he was outside the damage area. But still, as a dad, I think you kind of want to hear their voice. I mean, we live in the 21st century. It's not like we have to wait for a telegram carried by the Pony Express. Brian, to me, this seemed like a perfect example of a mission president who is more concerned with administering rather than ministering.
But on a positive note, LDS Humanitarian Aid has been heavily involved with this. The Daily Herald reported 9 trucks filled with supplies from the Church's Bishop's Central Storehouse and Humanitarian Center in Salt Lake City, which have arrived or are on their way with water, hygiene kits, food, including fresh milk, cleaning supplies, clothing, diapers, and wipes. One additional truck will also be sent to Houston. The church is also assisting in the Red Cross and Convoy of Hope in their relief efforts to help thousands of displaced people in Texas with food, water, cleaning kits, and hygiene items, which I have to say, given the price gouging that I've been seeing from local stores and supermarkets in Texas, I'm glad to see these charity organizations sending in these supplies, and I hope that it crushes these stores that are just jacking up their prices.
Amen.
The church is also partnering with Adventist Community Services in Houston.
You know what, Brian? Look, I am a cynical guy by nature, okay? It takes a lot to get me optimistic. But, you know, seeing everything that happened here is really what makes me happy. And especially, I'll say this, we try and just have some fun with the LDS Church and with Mormons and everything like that. We try not to get too serious about things, even though last couple of weeks we've had to. But I will say this, something like this makes me very proud to be a Mormon, because this is the way that we're supposed to react. And the fact that we've opened the doors to our stake centers, we've done all this stuff, and did it really without being asked, or like it was like stuff started happening, we just started doing it. That to me is really what true religion is. And I'm so glad that the church just without thinking, like, boom, we're going to send everything. And like you said, some of the shady stuff that's happening with some of the businesses down there jacking their prices up, ridiculous. So, okay. So we've got the positive out of the way. can we get into Joel Osteen now?
Do we have to?
Please, Brian. I've been waiting all week for this.
Okay, but listen, there better be a Mormon connection here, because, Brant, you're kind of on a short leash.
Okay, all right, let me try. Let's get the basics out of the way. Joel Osteen operates the largest, and when I say largest, 52,000 seats megachurch out of Houston. It's actually the old Houston Rockets basketball arena. And he received quite a bit of flack on social media due to his response to the flooding, or like Brian said, a lack of response. As a matter of fact, Professor Kate C. Bowler at Duke Divinity School called Osteen's response, quote, sluggish in her column at the Washington Post. And in the same BuzzFeed story that we talked about earlier, reporter Laura Turner goes through the timeline of Osteen's Lakewood Church's initial response to the flooding and some of the complexities behind the criticism of Osteen and Lakewood. I should probably give some more context. They didn't open their doors immediately. So the question being, was it a misunderstanding? Were the doors always open, as some claimed? Should Osteen and Lakewood have been more proactive in providing a sanctuary instead of being reactionary? Was there any additional flooding and safety concerns, which was the reason why they didn't open up the church?
What the Osteen story has done is really started a discussion again on the prosperity gospel, and that's something Mormons aren't immune to either.
Hold up. The prosperity gospel?
Yeah, it's a strain of religious belief among some Christians who hold that financial blessings and physical well-being are always the will of God for them, and that faith, positive speech, and donations to religious causes will increase one's material wealth.
I mean, we kind of have that in the LDS Church, don't we? I mean, didn't Elder Baller talk about it?
Opposite of what many had thought, prosperity and education seem to be connected to a higher likelihood of having traditional families and values. But the real question, of course, is about cause and effect. Do some sectors of our society have stronger values and families because they are more educated and prosperous? Or are they more educated and prosperous because they have values and strong families? In this worldwide church, we know that it is the latter. When people make the family and religious commitments to gospel principles, they begin to do better spiritually and often temporally as well.
Yes. And one could even tie the prosperity gospel to a very commonly known Mormon topic, the Book of Mormon pride cycle, where you keep the commandments, you prosper in the land, you get prideful and wicked, you get warned, there's a destruction and suffering, which humbles you and brings about repentance, and then you start all over again. Even D&C 130 verse 20 gets into it a bit. It says, quote, when we obtain any blessings from God, it is by obedience to the law upon which it is predicated.
Which kind of sounds like textbook prosperity gospel, but it's something I wish we'd talk about more, because while I don't know if we go to the extent of some of these evangelical preachers, we do kind of have it in other areas. I heard it all the time on my mission. If you be obedient, if you have faith, you're going to reap success, and that success is going to be more baptisms or more lessons or whatever you want to call it. And I think the problem with this concept is, to some people, prosperity could be very religious in nature. It could be a closeness with God or feeling more spiritual or whatever you'd want to call it, right? But at the same time, and this happens in Mormonism, we also prop up some individuals, specifically those who have been financially successful, as religious examples that others should be following. I'm looking at you, Deseret Book. Basically, we have a lot of work to do. All right, Brian, what else happened this week?
Brant, big news. We found the Book of Mormon. We did it. Well, kinda.
Go on.
So, we've got the Book of Mormon manuscript in virtually its entirety, but that's just one piece of the things. The crown jewel of the Book of Mormon, aside from, you know, the actual plates, is the original handwritten manuscript of Joseph Smith's dictation of the plates, and that we only have in fragments.
You know, it's something that historians have been looking for a long time. As a matter of fact, we only have, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, about 28% of the original handwritten manuscript. And last week, the Church History Department announced the acquisition of more fragments, which will be part of a forthcoming Joseph Smith Papers project book.
Yeah, so your friend and mine, Robin Scott Jensen, who's the Associate Managing Historian and Project Archivist for the Joseph Smith Papers Project, and really an all-around great dude, He told the Deseret News that the original manuscript was put into a cornerstone in the Nauvoo House by Joseph Smith in 1841. Sadly, when it was pulled out several decades later, water had seeped through, and the manuscript started just falling apart from the bottom up.
Jensen said that the early parts of the Book of Mormon were well preserved, so like the Nephite parts, right? But once they got down to Alma, it's just falling apart. There are very few full leaves, and when they're full, they're really worn away.
The manuscript was in possession of Lewis Biedemann, who married Emma after Joseph had passed away. when early missionaries would go on missions, they would often stop in the Midwest to visit different church history sites. And they found that if they visited Lewis Biedemann, he would give them a fragment of the original Book of Mormon as sort of a keepsake.
Well, the church leaders couldn't just ask for it outright, but you know what they did do? They sent people back in a steady stream on missions to get pieces here and there, which is how we ended up with the 28%.
You know, it's really cool stuff that they're doing over there. And from a historian's perspective, they're definitely doing things right.
So, Brian, can I rant just a little bit?
I'm thinking that if I said no, it probably still wouldn't stop you, would it?
No, because I probably just steamroll over you anyways. All right. Anyways, so I remember talking to someone when the Joseph Smith Papers Project was first getting started back in the early 2010s. And I will admit, I told you earlier, my cynicism was cranked up pretty high. This person was involved in the legal side of things, the documents on the legal side. And he told me, we're sick of people putting things out there and establishing the conversation. We've got everything. We want to put everything out with the highest possible scholarly quality so that nobody can challenge it and the proper context is right there. I think they've done a marvelous job with that. And every single time the Joseph Smith Papers Project releases something new, some of the same cast of characters comes out of the woodwork challenging it and making accusations that the church is holding back or they're editing things or they're putting selective things out or whatever you want to call it. However, if you talk to any legitimate scholar about the LDS church, whether they're an active practicing member of the church or a disaffected or even ex-Mormon, any scholar worth their salt will acknowledge that the church historian's office is doing a darn good job at things. I mean, I get it. There's a lot of emotion tied up in these things. And in the past, the LDS church hasn't always been the best acknowledging their history. But seriously, everyone, before you go throwing your accusatory grenades, why don't you do some research? Why don't you talk to a few people who've been around for a while and put your pitchforks away? You just look silly. So, Brian, I'm not sure if you've had any experience with the Joseph Smith Papers projects, but I mean, am I alone in thinking that?
No. It's every time they put anything out, it's what are they missing? What did they take out? What did they redact? And yeah, like you said, Brant, most legitimate historians and scholars, whether have never been Mormon, whether they are former Mormons, all acknowledge that they're doing a darn good job with this project. So, hey, switching topics. Brant, do you by chance have any plans to go to Idaho?
You know, Brian, I spent 4 years in Rexburg, and to some people, that's the equivalent of a lifetime. So I think I'm good for a little bit.
So I take it we're not going to see you at the Remnant Movement's Doctrine of Christ conference this weekend that's being held in Boise, will we?
Wait a minute. Isn't that the Snufferite group?
Oh, be careful, Brant. Don't call them that. They'll fight you.
You know what? If I'm not careful, they'll probably take a vote and censure me.
I'll make sure to let Denver know that he'll need to add this to his agenda because, believe it or not, voting is the main theme of this weekend's conference. So Peggy Fletcher Stack of the Trib reported that this group, who is expecting, quote, hundreds of voters, will be canonizing a new set of scriptures, including a reworking of the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants.
So this is where it gets interesting. Chris Hamill, a spokesperson for the project, said the last known major canonization was in 1672 by the Eastern Orthodox Church. So nothing like this has ever been seen in Orthodox or Protestant Christianity in nearly 350 years. Not even the Mormon Church or any of its offshoots ever formally canonized or accepted by common consent of the membership all their scriptures. This isn't a very important historic development, end quote.
So I think that the RLDS Church may contend with that last statement there a little bit because they do also have a by common consent canonization process. However, it's a fascinating movement. And you know, it gives me perhaps a little bit more insight into how early church movements such as the Strangites were able to grow and to prosper. People have been predicting the demise of the Remnant group here or the Snufferites or whatever you want to call them. They've been predicting their demise for years, especially without having a clear leader in place. Denver Snuffer doesn't want to be viewed as a prophet for them. And yet his strain of Mormonism has attracted a fairly strong following.
You know, I did a little bit of research, and as a matter of fact, the group claims to have 50 organizations affiliated across the world, with many of them being in Mormon hotspots like Utah and Idaho. So I think it's definitely something that we're going to have to keep an eye on for sure.
So, Brant, we've got to get into that thing.
Brian, I don't want to.
But Brant, we talked about this, you know, sacrifices bring forth the blessings of heaven or something. So let's just rip the Band-Aid off.
All right, fine. There is an organization out there called Mormon Leaks. They are a self-described nonprofit media organization who, quote, provides sources and whistleblowers the technical ability to anonymously submit sensitive documents for use by professional and citizen journalists for starting and expanding news reporting, public commentary, and criticism related to Mormonism.
They've released quite a few things in the past, and Brant, we've made a decision not to cover them unless it's a really big deal, right?
Right. So our theory is this. We both have some major disagreements with the tactics and methodology of Mormon leaks. Mostly, their objectivity that they claim to have, in our opinion, isn't true objectivity. Additionally, we both have some philosophical disagreements as to their release practices.
There isn't much due diligence. There isn't any context to the documents or any of the other information that they release. And it all seems to fall into the salacious category.
For example, there's a debate to be had about the compensation received by higher LDS ecclesiastical leaders whose church service is essentially full-time. There is a debate that needs to be had about that.
Yeah, and scholars such as Mike Quinn, who recently published a book on the topic of Mormonism and wealth and corporate power, is a great place to start that discussion.
As a matter of fact, future guest on the show.
There's a plug. Mike Quinn will be coming onto the show. But backing into this, the way that Mormon Leaks does it, it's not exactly the way to start the conversation, in my opinion. Releasing Henry B. Eyring's pay stub is tacky, classless, and frankly insulting. For the rest of the story, I think we should be referring to them as the site. And frankly, we don't want to give that much airtime.
All right, so enter the most recent video.
So Francis Bernard is a linebacker for BYU, and a video was released by the site showing an interaction between him and Provo City Police in December of 2016.
Provo police were responding to an incident involving a noise disturbance, and in the video, police were not only citing Mr. Bernard with the ticket, but also talking with him about the implications of the ticket and seemed to be giving some life advice to Bernard.
The Deseret News reported BYU announced earlier this month that Bernard, a junior, would redshirt this season for personal reasons. His brother has said publicly that the reason was related to the university's honor code. The Deseret News also learned that Bernard was convicted on charges of noise disturbance and disorderly conduct in two separate incidents that took place in 2016.
So as organizations were putting the pieces together, the site released a video we previously talked about stating, quote, upon receiving the video, this site discussed as a team as to whether or not there were any value in releasing the video to the public and if doing so helps advance our mission. Other than the threats made at the end of the video and the fact that the partygoers were so loud the police had to be called, we are not aware of them breaking any laws or engaging in any kind of activities that would not be normal for adults of their age range. Having said that, it is well known that BYU has a very strict honor code policy, and it is sometimes unclear how that policy is or is not enforced. This video, Mr. Bernard's suspension from the 2016 Poinsettia Bowl, and the fact that he has recently been forced to redshirt the 2017 season gives the public some insight as to how the honor code is applied to student athletes, end quote.
Yeah, the founder of the site also told KSL, our motivation in releasing this video was simply to shine a light on what we've suspected for many years, that there is not equity in the way that the honor code is applied to people at BYU.
Okay. So.
Hey, be careful, Brant.
All right. It's no secret that college athletes at big-time athletic schools in big-time sports have preferential treatment. I think we can all agree with that. That's not to excuse it. Obviously, there shouldn't be a double standard. However, it's not like this video recording was of an individual being let off from getting a ticket for a noise violation. The officers even say something along the lines of, this is happening, there's no backtracking. But the site releasing this video under the obviously perfectly well-intentioned auspices of shedding light on how the honor code is enforced is laughable.
And again, we're going to be a broken record soon on this one. Just so we're perfectly clear, BYU has a history with extremes in honor code enforcement and double standards when it comes to certain individuals. There's no question about that. Additionally, just because this individual was an athlete for BYU College's football team doesn't mean that they should have been dealt with any differently than, say, you or me.
Right. And let's not mince words here, okay? The reaction of Bernard to the individual who was recording the interaction between Bernard and the police was pretty extreme. He told the individual he was going to bleeping strangle you until you don't bleeping breathe. That's not good, period, point blank. That's a threat. That's not cool for someone to be saying for anyone, anywhere, in any circumstance, in any situation. But the fact that this is being shilled out by not just that site, but by others who are prominent in the online Mormon world without any information is disgusting.
Is there really a story here? Sure, I mean, if you want, but doesn't a big part of the story involve BYU's moral high ground when it comes to much of this?
Oh, totally. I think that's totally it. I mean, the University of Florida, who's going to be missing close to 10 players for their home opener against Michigan, they're going to be suspending 10 of those players due to different infractions for different things that are going on, okay? So sure, that's a big story all in itself. As a matter of fact, here in Michigan, we're hearing all about that, okay? But when you take the moral high ground of having your football players get firesides or of being the quote-unquote Lord University and his chosen football team, when incidents like this happen, yeah, it's really not surprising that there are a lot out there who are looking for any opportunity for you to fall.
The story was picked up by Deseret News, KSL, Fox 13 in Utah, KUTV in Utah, and Raw Story. We're not going to link to, you know, that site or the video in the show notes because, honestly, that site doesn't deserve your clicks. You'll have to find it elsewhere, but suffice it to say this. When the only information being leaked by this group is harmful to the LDS Church and the only moral backing the founders have to fall back on is, well, we just released the information that we're given. It's not our call what people send in. It's a cheap way of desperately remaining relevant.
You know what, Brian? How about you call me when something big happens? Why don't you call me when something with some legitimate analysis and commentary occurs? Call me if there's a legitimate cover-up of a legitimate issue. Do not call me when a college football player gets a ticket and that same 20-something football player wants to call his coach. Don't call me when an online Mormon ambulance chaser who is trying to remain relevant does a podcast about the story because he's decided it's a story. Don't call me when another chapter in the ex-Mormon book of disaffected fairy tales is released because someone is so apoplectic that they are near euphoric in their sophomoric fantasy that this is going to be the one thing that finally brings the church down. Why don't you guys all just grow up, all right? Why don't you do something with your life instead of shilling out for anyone with any sort of ash to grind against the LDS church to send them any document that they find that may or may not put the church in a good or bad light, because that's how you have to back up your own moral ground for, hey, we're totally objective. Anyways. We'll be back with Mehdi Harrison. If you're looking for more current news coverage on Mormonism, why don't you try the Mormon News Report? The Mormon News Report is a weekday email sent hot and fresh to your inbox every day by 9 a.m. covering the top stories in Mormonism with just a tiny bit of snark. Our focus is on actual news from actual newspaper and reporters covering all aspects of Mormonism. If you're interested in signing up, email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com with your name and zip code. We use that for demographic purposes. You could like the Mormon News Report on Facebook. You could find us on Twitter at The Mormon News or visit theculturalhall.com/Mormon-news-report for more information.
Limbo lower now. Limbo lower now. How low can you go? First you spread your limbo feet, then you move the limbo beat. Limbo.
We'd like to welcome onto the show Mehdi Harrison. Mehdi is the author of numerous books for young adults, including The Princess and the Hound and Mirror Mirror. The Bishop's Wife is her critically acclaimed adult mystery and the first in the Linda Walheim series set in Mormon, Utah, which includes His Right Hand and For Time and All Eternities. I will also add that The Bishop's Wife is one of my wife's favorite books. She really loved writing it and actually wrote a review at theculturalhall.com. You could look it up and you could see what her review was. But her new book, The Book of Layman, is actually quite different. It touches on a lot of the same Mormon themes, but it's actually a retelling of the story in 1st and 2nd Nephi from the Book of Mormon, but it's actually from Layman's point of view. So we're going to get into this and more. But first, Mehdi, welcome onto the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. Hello, everyone.
So, Mehdi, you and I have a special connection. You were one of the original subscribers to the Mormon News Report newsletter, and so I can definitely call you a friend of the report. But before we get into some of that, I do have a very important question for you. Is your favorite Mormon news email daily digest sent every day at 9 o'clock in the morning the Mormon News Report? And if it's not, do you have any plans to repent anytime soon?
It's definitely my favorite.
That's what I like to hear. So let's talk a little bit about your journey because you've kind of taken this interesting route to becoming an author. So by my count, you've published about a dozen novels, but you also have a PhD in Germanic languages and literatures from Princeton. So when did you decide to go for the writing angle versus the more academic angle on things?
Well, it's actually the reverse. I knew that I wanted to be a writer when I was in kindergarten. I have this really strong memory of drawing a picture of a rainbow dragon on one of those giant newsprint pieces of paper. And back when I was in elementary school, they didn't teach kids how to write in kindergarten. So my teacher came over to me and asked me if there was a story to go along with this dragon. And I told her the story. She wrote it down. And I still have it. My mother, bless her heart, she kept all of my early stories and novels and gave them to me when I moved out of the house. And so I still have that. I think it's up on my website somewhere. But my teacher said to me, I bet you're going to be a writer when you grow up. And I remember that moment thinking, yes, that is what I want. And anytime anybody would ask me that dreaded question of what do you want to be when you grow up, I always said I wanted to be a writer. When I got a little older, 13 or so, my parents started to caution me against that strategy. They kept saying, well, that's a lovely hobby, but you should get a real job. And so this may sound ridiculous, but going into academia was my idea of getting a real job. I love to read, and I thought I could use my love of reading to get paid. And it worked for a little while. I lived in Germany my sophomore year in high school, and I went to a German gymnasium. And so I did speak quite fluent German, and it just seemed an easy path. So, well, at least the BA was easy. I wouldn't say the PhD was exactly easy, but I taught at BYU for several years until I realized that that energy that you get that helps you, the creative energy that you use to write, was being stolen by teaching and reading other people's literature and talking about other people's literature. And I just needed more time to be quiet and think about my own stories. So I quit and decided to become a full-time writer and spent the next 2 years working really hard. I wrote almost 20 novels in that time period, and then published the 21st one. I've never met anybody who wrote 20 novels without being published, although I think Brandon Sanderson and I might be similar in terms of word count. His novels are much, much longer than mine were. So it was a long road. And I talk to people a lot about how to become a writer, how to get published. There's a lot of luck involved and a lot of hard work.
And now you're running a blog, at least on writing advice, right? If not, considering turning that into a podcast. Is that correct?
I am thinking about doing a podcast. This summer's been very hectic with, I have one daughter, my fourth child has been going off to college, and I've got kids in and out. And so I'm thinking maybe in September, I'll think about that. Right now I write a daily post on Facebook, and I also put it up on Tumblr. I keep thinking I need to update my website with a blog, but so far it's not really on a blog. It's just on Facebook.
Yeah. Well, I enjoy reading those every day, and I'm not even a writer, but I still enjoy the inspiration that I get out of them. So let's move into your newest book, The Book of Layman. And it was published by a fairly new press, BCC Press, which yes, of course we've supported several times on this show. Yours is what, like the fifth book, I think, that they've published.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've had a chance to chat with Tracy McKay and Melissa Leilani Larson. Rachel Steinblick is coming on the show as well. So, I mean, we love what BCC Press is doing. So what I'm about to say, I don't intend in any sort of negative light or to minimize them in any way. But my question is how did you end up working with them? I mean, you're an accomplished novelist, and you're one of Soho Press's authors, and they're kind of the big leagues. So how did this relationship with BCC Press start?
Well, there's a longer story about that, which is that when I first started writing for a national market, I tried very hard never to write about anything Mormon, because I felt strongly that nobody was interested in it, and I wasn't sure how to do it without offending people or making it sound sentimental or smarmy. So I published my first book in 2002, and until 2014, I avoided everything about Mormonism. And then I published The Bishop's Wife, which was definitely a lot about Mormonism. So I sort of had this course back towards Mormonism and wanting to write about it. And I'm not sure that I solved the problem of not offending people. But I started writing more and more about Mormonism, and right before The Bishop's Wife was published, I had this itch that I wanted to write the Book of Layman. Sometimes ideas just come to you and demand to be written. And so in 2014, I wrote the whole manuscript to send it out to a few friends. And I didn't think it would ever be published. I couldn't imagine working with any of the currently running local presses, Deseret Book or, well, Mumble Mumble. I just didn't think they'd be interested in it. And honestly, I thought that I might have a black mark against my name sort of in certain circles. Although I consider myself quite faithful to Mormonism. I dearly love the church, and I do criticize it sometimes, but I also talk a lot about how I've come back to Mormonism more firmly than I ever was before. And so this book was part of my journey. It was an attempt to go back to my roots and write about something I love. And I honestly didn't think it would ever get published. I thought I was just writing it for myself and a couple of friends. And it wasn't until it was funny, like the day that I saw that BCC had become an independent press and they showed the names of the two authors they had. So it was Tracy McKay Lamb and Stephen Peck, both of whom I admire enormously. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is my chance. So I sent an email off to Michael Austin. We'd been in contact before. And I said, would you be interested in this book that I have? And he said, yes, send it right now. And then I panicked because I needed to revise it a bit. My friends had given me some feedback and I knew there were a couple things I needed to fix. So I madly spent the next month trying to change a few little things and then sent it off. And it was published very quickly after that. So it's been a whirlwind. And I've just been so happy that there's another option out there for, you know, just I'm not going to say it's a more radical Mormonism, but maybe more progressive, maybe just a little slightly different take on what Mormonism is.
Well, and I'll echo that. And I'll go along with that by saying, I think from what I've heard from both nonfiction and fiction authors, Deseret Book has a very specific editorial process and a very specific tone that they're looking for. And I think by opening it up to other avenues, whether it's BCC Press or by Greg Coford or something like that, you're giving a lot more different perspectives on Mormonism throughout the whole spectrum. And I've always thought that that is needed. It's necessary within our group, especially when you're talking about things like what you're writing, which is fiction. So let's get into the book a little bit. First off, I really want to applaud you on it because I thought it was a very creative way of approaching it. And I don't know if we've seen a lot of that within Mormonism. I mean, we have some historical fiction, but this is actually taking a book of scripture and looking at it through different lenses. And I do have to commend you. I don't know if it was you or Mike Austin or somebody else, but the cover of the book is phenomenal. And it's in this package and I open it. And my wife by this point is used to all the, you know, random book packages we get. And she goes, did someone send you a Book of Mormon? And I had to show it to her and say, no, it says the Book of Layman. And like, that's what it looks like. It's great. I like it because even if you know the story in First or Second Nephi, there's a lot of interesting perspectives and a lot of things that you add. So the question I have for you is, what prompted you to tell the story from the perspective of Layman versus the traditional perspective in the Book of Mormon of Nephi?
Well, I think when I was a teenager, I always thought of myself as Nephi. Like, I was very devout and I liked lists of rules and I followed them exactly and carefully. I probably would be the sort of person that would be really annoying to the person I am now, probably annoyed everybody who was around me at the time. I took pleasure in making long lists of accomplishments that I had done even into my 20s. I graduated from BYU with a master's and a bachelor's degree in 2 years after I graduated from high school. So I was 19 when I went off to Princeton. And I just considered myself like, oh, I was a Benson Scholar at BYU too. So I just considered myself to be like the best of all Mormonism. And I spent some time really believing that of myself. And then something happened about in my 30s where I realized that all of the things that I thought were good about myself turned out to have this darker side. Like, my intense focus on academics and on achievement is linked to a lack of interest in social communication. And with kids around, I now struggle sometimes. My kids have to remind me, like, Mom, we have to go here. Or they, like, the timer's beeping. I literally cannot hear things if I'm too focused on my writing or my work. And that's great for getting work done, but it leaves relationships sort of out in the cold. And I can see now that that is how I read Nephi in many ways. And I have come, I feel like I'm a very different person now than I was. I'm 46 now, and I have become somebody who embraces weird things like uncertainty and grace. The idea of failure and imperfection are things that I find a deeply important part of the gospel. And those are things that I really never cared about before. And so for me, I've now rejected this Nephi persona. And I don't mean to imply that, like, that my version of Laman is better than Nephi. That's clearly, Laman does not see himself as better than Nephi by any stretch of the imagination. He watches Nephi. He knows Nephi's the chosen one. He's the prophet. He's the one that everybody loves. And he can see why, because Nephi, he does whatever he's asked to do. But I liked the idea of going back and retelling the story. I do a lot of retellings. I've done lots of fairy tale retellings for the young adult audience. So for me, it was a similar process. Like, you know how the story goes, you know the points, but you're uncovering the deeper story underneath, the character story. Because fairy tales are very simple. They're just plot oriented. They're really just like kind of an outline of a novel. And as the author, my job is to tell you the character story that goes along with the events that happened, like explain how the character development goes from a point here to point A to point B and shows how somebody grew. And so for me, that's the story of Laman. Is he is a broken character to begin with. He doesn't have a good relationship with his father, and his younger brother is better than he is at everything. And yet, this is a story of redemption. It's a story about God saying, you are still my beloved son. You are my child, and I want you to come home to me. And how could I write this is the challenge. Like, how could I write a story about a character who is a bad guy? And I don't mean to make him into a good guy, but who still finds redemption.
Yeah. Yep. No, I agree. And there's a sincerity and a genuineness to him that, you know, sometimes if you're reading the Book of Mormon, it just won't be there. And I really appreciate that.
To say that Laman isn't depicted very positively in the Book of Mormon is probably an understatement. Right? and granted, with the Book of Mormon being written from the perspective of Nephi, it means that Laman was perpetually cast as the unrighteous villain of the story. I mean, not only did he repeatedly beat up his younger brother, Nephi, but he eventually split from the family in open rebellion, and his descendants became the Lamanites, who were bitter enemies for a century with the descendants of Nephi. It's kind of the ultimate story of sibling rivalry. But you flipped the script a little bit on this, and by showing not only an empathetic view of Laman, but also that Nephi could be sort of a pompous jerk, as you were discussing. At least from time to time, right? And sometimes this gets humorous. So let me just read one excerpt that I found amusing. So this is when Laman is recalling Nephi's well-known speech that has been memorized by every Mormon kid since primary. It's the famous, "I will go and I will do the things the Lord commands" speech. Well, at the end of Nephi's declaration, Laman remarks, "Sam was looking up at Nephi in awe. Lemuel rolled his eyes. I was thinking again about striking Nephi across the face." There is a certain portion of me that could just relate to that. But before this scene, Laman remarked something that you had kind of touched on a moment ago. He said, "Yes, I knew that Nephi was the most faithful one of us. I knew that God and Father loved him best. But could he lord it over us just a little less?" So I just wanted to talk about the character of Laman a little bit more. You've given us a little bit of insight, but how did you find his voice?
You know, people ask questions like that of writers, and I hate to give some kind of weird magical answer, but it just came to me. That's what forced me to write that book, is that I just could hear Laman in my head. And the process of writing the book almost felt like my agent sometimes says that I channel voices. It didn't feel like I was shaping the story. It just felt like I was writing what he was telling me to write. But to analyze that from a slightly different perspective, because I know that characters don't actually exist and don't actually come and speak to authors. My guess is that I had read the Book of Mormon so many times, and I don't think that I am doing anything particularly creative to show Nephi as an annoying, kind of arrogant character. I think a lot of people read the Book of Mormon that way. But the real creativity came from giving Laman a chance to be a real character, have depth. And I would just say, like, the Book of Mormon is a huge sweeping text of like 1,000 years of history. So it's not a huge surprise that there's not a chance to give those characters, even Lehi's family, who get the most of the story at the beginning, they're not telling character development. They're telling you like plot and spiritual history. So part of the answer there is I don't know. And part of it is just, I feel like I have been on Laman's journey where I became the person who wasn't good anymore. I was an atheist for a long time. I lost a daughter in 2005 and was shattered spiritually by that event. And I think that's part of the reason that I came back to Laman's character rather than Nephi's, was that I felt like I was not good enough anymore. I had like betrayed the trust. I'd let down my family and broken covenants. And that's how Laman feels. He feels like he's not worthy to be loved, and yet he still finds that God loves him absolutely.
So talking a little bit more about the way that you structured the book and some of the things you get into, you make some pretty touching choices on what are some, frankly, some troubling events. For example, most people are aware of Nephi murdering Laban to obtain the gold plates. And for some, this is one of the most disturbing scenes in the entire Book of Mormon, if for nothing else, because God not only seemed to approve of the murder, but he kind of even pushed Nephi to do it. And in your story, Nephi seems to carry this, hey, I did what I had to do type of attitude. But Laman seems to be haunted by it and tormented by it. And you imply that he has this vision that it was going to happen. Can you talk to us a little bit about this scene?
I think I spend a lot of time, because I'm an author, even in real life, trying to figure out why people do what they do. So I tell myself stories all the time about, like, here's somebody who's doing something that I don't approve of or I don't like, and then why are they doing that? So to me, that was just another example of Nephi's doing this thing. How does Laman feel about it? I just sort of tried to put myself into his skin, and Laman feels like he should have been the one to do it. He's the older brother, and he also feels like he's the bad guy anyway. And so for him to have murdered somebody else in his mind is, it wouldn't have added that much to how bad he already was. But he is tormented. Like, he's annoyed by his younger brother, but he loves Nephi deeply. And he feels a deep sense of responsibility to make sure that Nephi's okay. This is his little brother. And I have enough brothers, and I have two sons who are 6 years apart in age. And I could just imagine that, you know, they fight with each other, but there's a deep love there. And so Laman just feels like he should have been the one to do it. And he's forever haunted by this guilt that Nephi now is going to have to bear whatever the sin is of having done that. And he can't live with that.
So, Mehdi, can you stick around just a little bit longer and chat with us? We'd like to put some stuff on our extended session feed, if you wouldn't mind.
Sounds great.
Okay. So for those of you who aren't Patreon members, you can sign up at patreon.com/Mormon News Report. The Book of Laman by Mehdi Harrison is now available through amazon.com, createspace.com, and local area bookstores. You can also listen to our extended interview if you are a Patreon subscriber. And if you are, and we thank you, you can listen there. Mehdi, thanks again for taking the time to talk to us. We'll be right back.
Scriptures are complex. Written over several thousand years by numerous authors from varying cultures and languages, many passages contain multiple meanings and possible interpretations. Furthermore, our present cultural situation unavoidably colors our own means of interpretation. What scripture scholars undertake is a study of the cultural situation of the text. Contemporary Studies in Scripture is an exciting new series from Greg Coford Books, featuring authors whose works engage in rigorous textual analyses of the Bible and other LDS scripture. Written by Latter-day Saints for a Latter-day Saint audience, these books utilize the tools of historical criticism, literature, philosophy, and the sciences to celebrate the richness and complexity found in the standard works. This series will provide readers with new and fascinating ways to read, study, and reread these sacred texts. Learn more about the Contemporary Studies in Scripture series by visiting gregcoford.com.
And now for your moment in Mormon history, brought to you by Today in Mormon History. 140 years ago this week, on August 29th, 1877, Brigham Young dies in Salt Lake City at 4 o'clock p.m. of an appendicitis at age 76. He led the LDS Church for 33 years. His last words were recorded to be, "Joseph, Joseph, Joseph." 50,000 people attended the viewing. He leaves 23 widows, of whom 17 receive a share of his estate. Young's personal secretary, L. John Nuttall, writes that he felt that the mastermind of Utah and in the whole world had been called away, leaving a blank and a sorrowful time for the Latter-day Saints. Young had wanted to appoint his son, Apostle Brigham Young Jr., as his successor, but many in the church's hierarchy opposed the establishment of a dynasty, which is interesting considering what happened later with a certain strand, but we'll get into that at another time. The office of the president of the church is not filled for over 3 years. His first counselor, George Q. Cannon, wrote, quote, "He was in my eyes as perfect a man as I ever knew. I never desired to see his faults. I closed my eyes to them. To me, he was a prophet of God, the head of the dispensation of the earth, holding the keys under the prophet Joseph, and in my mind, they're clustered about him holding this position, everything holy and sacred and to be revered."
So Brigham Young was a very complex and paradoxical character, but you know, Mormonism as we know it doesn't really survive without him. So just a couple of fun facts about this. Number one, George Q. Cannon never actually opened his eyes.
which is a very, it's a very interesting when you see everything that happened, right?
Yeah, he was like Mr. Magoo, you know, he's always squinting. Number two, just as an interesting kind of parallel, the last words from Emma Smith were also "Joseph, Joseph." So as much as those two fought like cats and dogs in oil and water, at the end, both of them, their reverence for husband, prophet, was the last things on their mind. Mm-hmm. And finally, as a fun fact, do you know who the second longest living LDS church president behind Brigham Young was?
Okay, let me think about this. If I were to guess, I would say probably, what about David O. McKay? I know he was in there for a while.
Well, McKay was the third longest surviving LDS church president at 18 years and 9 months, but the correct answer was Heber J. Grant, who served from November 1918 to May 1945 for a grand total of 26 years and 5 months.
Well, now.
Yeah, and the shortest serving church president?
I know this one because it happened in my lifetime. That would be Howard W. Hunter, who was LDS church president for less than a year, and something I learned today, the only church president to not make it the entire first year. Okay, so Brian, what about President Monson? Where does he stand within this listing?
As of today, he's at 9 years and 6 months from when he began his tenure in February of 2008. And let's hope that President Monson has many more years in front of him. And that's our show. We'd like to thank Mehdi Harrison for being our guest today.
Remember to check out the Mormon News Report extended sessions on Patreon. You can visit patreon.com and search Mormon News Report, or we'll make it easy, patreon.com/Mormon News Report, and you can become a subscriber today.
And we'd like to thank Scott Holmes for the music.
We'd especially like to thank you, our wonderful loyal listeners. If you like what we're doing, you can tell your friends about us. We even gave you a perfect example earlier in the show. And if you really want to help us out, why don't you go ahead and give us a review on iTunes? Just a little review goes a long way in helping people find us.
And if you'd like to reach out to us directly, let us know how we're doing. You can email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com.
Matter of fact, Brian, I think we should start a new segment, questions and answers with Brian. So if you have any intriguing Mormon questions, send them to Brian and I'll send the juiciest ones his way. Until next week, we will talk to you again after a while.